the appellant Oxford, Kerry Oxford, Andrea Reynolds will argue, and on behalf of the respondent state of Idaho, Cale Gans will argue. Are there any preliminary motions?
No, Your Honor.
Very well, you may proceed on behalf of the appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. Kerry Oxford suffers from a severe mental illness. She was diagnosed with schizophrenia 30 years ago and was initially determined to be incompetent to proceed in this case. Ms. Oxford's competency was restored after she was hospitalized, and she was tried by a jury who found her guilty of kidnapping and burglary. Almost inconceivably, the jury learned nothing of Ms. Oxford's mental illness, which could have provided a complete defense to the charges against her. And her attorney was instructed to make no reference to mental health issues in closing. The district court made two critical errors in this case. First, the district court denied defense counsel's motion for funds to retain an expert witness. The court recognized Ms. Oxford could present expert testimony on whether her mental illness affected her ability to possess the requisite criminal intent, but denied a request for funds to pay for such an expert. Second,
you characterized that as a denial. I thought he said pay it out of the public defender budget.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's what the district court ruled, but that is in effect a denial in this case, as there was no money in the public defender budget. Public defender's
was
budget.
There another motion made?
There was not, Your Honor. There was just the motion on the eve of trial to permit Dr. Trauber to testify.
Thank you.
The second error the district court made in this case relates to that latter motion with respect to Dr. Trauber. The district court refused to permit Dr. Trauber, who performed the competency evaluation early on, to testify as an expert. The court concluded Dr. Trauber's testimony would be irrelevant because he could not provide an opinion regarding her intent. The district court abused its discretion, and for either or both of these reasons, this court should vacate Ms. Oxford's conviction and remand this case to the district court for a new trial. Ms. Oxford also challenges the district court's restitution order in this appeal, but submits that issue on the briefs unless there are questions. So turning to the first issue, the district court's denial of a request for funds to retain an expert witness. We know from U.S. Supreme Court law from this court that this is a constitutional issue. It was raised in the district court. The law is fairly clear from Ake v. Oklahoma, a case from 1985. Quote, when a defendant demonstrates to the trial judge that his sanity at the time of the offense is to be a significant factor at trial, the state must, at a minimum, assure the defendant access to a competent psychiatrist who will conduct an appropriate examination and assist in evaluation, preparation, and presentation of the defense. That clearly did not happen in this case.
Counsel, again, I guess along with the chief's comments from earlier, in looking at the transcript, what the trial judge said was, the public defender's office does have, I think, an expert witness portion of the budget. So I would think that I'm reluctant to order that the district court pay for it if there is a budget for that.
Right.
Now, how could that be construed as a denial? It sounded to me like the court was willing to have the expert testify, was willing to have it paid for through the public defender's budget, but he didn't foreclose other sources paying for it. What prevented defense counsel from asking that the funds be ordered by the court through a different mechanism?
Well, Your Honor, the motion was a request for funds. There's no requirement that a party asks the district court for permission merely to retain an expert. Here, the motion was a request for money to pay for that expert. So by denying that request, it was a denial of that motion.
Should the court have even directed, typically, I'm not sure how all judges do this, but I think a lot of judges just typically say it'll be paid for at state expense or it'll be paid for at county expense, and let the public defender work with the county in getting funding for it. Is the error just that the judge designated a source of the funds as a possible way of paying for it?
Well, Your Honor, the error is that the judge denied the request for funds. Had the judge said it will be at county expense or state expense, then presumably defense counsel would have proceeded to retain that expert, follow the procedure set forth in, what is it, Rule 12.2, and proceeded to hire that expert. But here—
How can we find, though, a denial in the record? I don't find the word deny being used anywhere in the record. The judge just said, look, why don't you look to this source to pay for it? Aren't you asking us to go pretty far to treat that as a denial?
Well, Your Honor, it's clear that it was a denial in that the request was for money. There was a denial of that money. It's the money that is the key. Again, it's not the permission to hire an expert. Anyone can go hire whatever expert they want. It's the payment for that expert. And the district court's ruling was a denial of funds, of money, to retain and pay for that expert.
So what was the specific relief that was requested in terms of the source of that funding?
Funding from the state. It wasn't clear whether it was going to be the county. The words used below were the district court.
So does the district court have an obligation to pay for this expert?
The state has the obligation to pay for the expert. And that's clear from cases from, you know, 20 plus years back. It's the state's obligation to pay for that expert. And again, I think I touched on this briefly.
So what kind of order does the district court enter?
An order saying that the funds will be paid for at state expense. Again, as to the particulars of that, Justice Mueller, I see you nodding, and you might have more familiarity with how procedurally this happens typically in the district court. But in this case, what I would have liked to see was an order granting defense counsel's motion saying, yes, Ms. Oxford may retain such an expert to assist in the evaluation, preparation, and presentation of defense, and that will be paid for out of state funds. At a later date, that could be determined whether those come from the county, the state, the public defender, whatnot. That's not the issue as to where they come from. The issue is whether they will be paid for.
Does a district judge even have the authority to do that? Does a district judge have the authority to say this is going to be paid for from this pot of money? Isn't that really up to the public defender to determine where they're going to get the funding from? The judge doesn't have authority over the county's budget and can't say, well, we're going to direct the county to move money from the roads crew into the public defender fund to pay for this. Don't those decisions usually get made at the county level and the commissioners decide how they're going to pay for it?
Well, the district court definitely has the authority to order that the funds be paid by the state. And whether that's the state, the county, how that's done, excuse me, procedurally, I don't know the district court can order this be paid by the public defender, this be paid by the county. I think you're correct there. But certainly, the district court has the ability and here has the obligation under the Constitution and under Idaho statute to say that these funds must be made available to the defendant. And that's what did not happen here.
Ms. Reynolds, I read what Judge Dunn did to be, I agree with you, Ms. Oxford, that you're entitled to an expert. But I think the county public defender has money in its budget to pay for this, and therefore I'm authorizing and will allow the expert to testify, but as I understand it, the resources are not available to me to order. And the problem I have with what the trial attorney did is that he or she never brought it back to the judge and said, Judge, I recognize that we have a budget, but the budget is not going to pay for this money. And so I now request that you issue an order that the county pay for the expert that you have already acknowledged is reasonable and necessary for the defense of Ms. Oxford. And that was never done in this case. And that's the problem I have with the posture of the case as it currently sits.
You're correct, Your Honor, that the defense counsel did not come back to the court to make a second request for funds to pay for the expert. I think you can tell from the record that defense counsel interpreted that first order, however the court might be looking at it, they interpreted that first order as a denial of funds. Now, to the extent there's a dispute between the public defender's office, trial counsel, the district court, as to who pays for that funds, our focus here needs to be on the defendant, on Ms. Oxford. She was denied her constitutional right to have an expert to evaluate, prepare, and present what could have been a defense that absolved her of all criminal liability in this case.
And the judge approved that.
I'm sorry?
The judge approved that concept, that she would have an expert to testify to those facts.
The judge denied the request for funds. Again, there's no requirement that the judge approve a party's request to go retain an expert. It's the money that's the key. Now, I agree, defense counsel could have come back before the district court and said, you know, I tried to get this money from the public defender's office. There was no money available. And it might be a cleaner issue for this court to consider on appeal. However, it's certainly raised here. It was raised below, decided by low, below. The issue squarely presented. And you can see from the way this case progressed in the district court that it had the impact of denying her right to the expert that might have made a critical difference here.
Shouldn't defense counsel, though, when realizing that there was no funds in the public defender fund available for this, he or she had two options at that point. One is to go to the commissioners and say, we need more money in the fund to pay for this expert. Or two, going to the court and saying, hey, you predicated this on this fund being available and it's not available. So can you direct us to get the fund somewhere else? It seems to me that the defense attorney is washing their hands of any culpability in carrying out the order that the judge issued.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think so. Most respectfully, the defense counsel did go back to the district court, did tell the district court that there were no funds available to hire that expert. In conjunction with asking the district court to allow Dr. Trauber to testify. Now, presumably, the attorney made a decision that Dr. Trauber's testimony would be sufficient to succeed in this case. It might not have resolved all the constitutional issues, but it might have made that earlier error harmless.
Can you please point in the record where it shows that the attorney made a request of the judge to get funds from an alternate source?
There's none there. But what happened is there was not a second request to the district court, but what there was is a statement to the district court that funds were not available, combined with the request to permit Dr. Trauber to testify as both a fact and expert witness in the case. So I assume that the trial counsel made a decision that because the funds were not available, Dr. Trauber's testimony would be sufficient to present the defense so that the jury could consider her mental health issues. So it's really, the two issues are intertwined in this case. It's the resolution of that second motion, the district court's denial of the motion to permit Dr. Trauber to testify, that made the first decision so incredibly harmful. Had Dr. Trauber been allowed to testify, it's possible that the denial of funds, or if you will, the ruling that the funds be paid by the public defender, might not have had an impact on the outcome of this case. Had the jury been able to hear Dr. Trauber provide fact and opinion regarding Ms. Oxford's mental health.
Excuse me a second. It's not in the record, or I didn't see it. The trial attorney was, in fact, an employee of the public defender's office?
I don't know. Let me take a look at the motion. It appears that the trial counsel was J. Scott Andrew, a deputy public defender with the Bannock County Public Defender's Office.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry to interrupt.
And I think there's some concern. Well, was trial counsel ineffective? Was the public defender's office at fault here? I don't think this is an IAC claim, and I don't think that this court can simply punt to the public defender's office or say this should be dealt with in post-conviction. The framework we need to look at this through is Ms. Oxford's constitutional rights, and the law
Hold on a minute. Isn't the framework here, I mean, and you said previously that the focus has to be on the defendant, and I understand that to some degree, but on appeal, the question that we are focusing on is, did the district court commit an error? That's the focus, and did that error impact her rights? But that the first inquiry is, did the district court err?
And Your Honor, I think that inquiry can be resolved here. The district court did err in ruling on that motion that the funds would not be paid for by the district court, which was the request, even though, Justice Mueller, I understand that might not be the particular entity. The error was saying, yes, I see that there's a basis for that. However, I'm going to order that you go to the public defender for those funds. So the error is not outright granting the motion and saying, yes, Ms. Oxford has a right to that expert assistance. The state will provide the funds. We'll figure out at a later date how those are specifically paid. The initial ruling on that motion should have been granted. Ms. Oxford gets the expert. But that was not the ruling. It was, in effect, a denial in that, again, the money is the key. So in AIC, the United States Supreme Court held, quote, the state's interest in its FISC must yield where a defense may be devastated by the absence of a psychiatric examination and testimony. But with such assistance, the defendant might have a reasonable chance of success. And the money is key. It might seem like a secondary issue, but it's not. Again, there's no requirement that you preview your case to the district court and say, we're thinking of getting this expert and this expert and this expert. What do you think? That's not.
But in this case, didn't the district court in essence give that preview? My read of the record is that the district court told defense counsel the workaround, that is to rely on the evaluation expert, isn't a good workaround unless you can lay the foundation about intent at the time of the crime and not at the time of the evaluation. I'm not going to allow this expert to testify. I mean, I read that the district court told defense counsel, you've got a problem.
Well, Your Honor, I think that ruling came right before trial. You're right that when defense counsel came back to the court and said, I was not able to hire an expert, we're moving for permission to present Dr. Trauber's expert. The district court said, well, I assume you have another opinion from Dr. Trauber. Defense counsel said, no, we have the initial report from the competency evaluation. That's all that was done. It was at that point that the district court said, just what you expressed, I don't see how this could come in. And that is the second error in this case. And it's helpful to look at these two decisions together, as I think the second error magnifies the problem that initially happened. The district court concluded that Dr. Trauber's testimony was completely irrelevant to the case. And it's almost hard to think about, you know, that's the magnitude of that. The evidence was irrelevant. I mean, relevance is defined extremely broadly under IRE 401, this court's recent decision in Garcia. It's evidence having any tendency to make the existence of any fact as a consequence of the determination of the action more or less probable than it would be without the evidence. Certainly, Dr. Trauber's testimony as to the facts of his evaluation of Ms. Oxford and his expert opinion as to what her previous diagnoses mean, what a psychotic disorder means, what hallucinations can mean, all of that make the determination of a fact of consequence to this action more or less probable.
But Trauber has to be able to say that on the date that Oxford takes the baby away from her neighbor, that she was acting in the opinion of Dr. Trauber in a psychotic or delusional or however you want to describe it way. And when Trauber's only hired to find out whether she's competent at the time that he evaluates her, and counsel hasn't gone into Trauber's expertise and found that he does have an opinion that, yes, when she is clutching the baby and saying that it's her now 20-something-year-old son, that she was delusional and that she was suffering from delusions and that she had no grasp of reality and she had no conception that what she was doing was wrong. We'd have a much different case if counsel had said to Trauber, well, do you have an opinion as to what her mental state was on the date that the crime purportedly occurred? But when he says, no, I don't have any additional opinions, then I agree with your statement that the district court was correct to conclude that Dr. Trauber could not testify, that based on his evaluation, Ms. Oxford was unable to form the specific intent necessary to commit these crimes. This strikes me more as a ineffective assistance of counsel, frankly, than an error by the trial judge. When Dunn is asked to say, can she have an expert, he says yes. And my understanding is that you have a fund from which you can pay for that expert. And then the attorney comes back and says, well, we talked about it and we have a first degree murder trial and we're going to devote our resources to that. But doesn't say, and therefore we want you to pay, we want the district court to pay for the this expertise, that strikes me as ineffective assistance of counsel more than a denial of Ms. Oxford's rights at the time. And that's...
Ms. Reynolds, I'd like to ask a question in this regard. It seems to me that if we agree with your arguments here today, number one, the ripple effect in the future will be that unless a district judge or the trial judge goes out and actually inquires of the different funding mechanisms of the county or the state, then that is an error on behalf of that district judge. Seems to me that that takes a very active position in the the position of the judge, which is in fact to be an unbiased person running the trial, as opposed to finding money for witnesses for one side. Secondarily, it seems to me your second argument is I go to a doctor and diagnoses that I have an appendicitis, and then you want that doctor to testify that I had in fact a heart murmur, and that doctor says I can't testify to a heart murmur, therefore I can't go forward. This is a very dangerous case that you're arguing. Tell me why this must happen as opposed to an IAC claim.
Sure. First, I think it's the exact opposite of what you said. I'm not saying that the district court should have been more particular about the funding request. I'm saying exactly the opposite. The district court should have simply granted that motion, and the funding issue should have been worked out separate and apart from that. So again, it's not that the court should have figured out, does the money come from this budget? Does it come from this budget? Do we need to get approval here? It's actually a lesser burden on the district court. The district court's job was to say, under the law, yes. Yes, you get that expert. Yes, it's paid by the state. And the funding issue can be sorted out separate once we have the 12.2 motion. All that can be figured out later. It's that was the problem here. With respect to the relevance, to address both your concern and Justice Stegner's concern, it does not make Dr. Trauber's testimony irrelevant simply because he could not opine as to her intent on the date of the alleged criminal conduct. The jury heard nothing about her mental illness, about what those mental illnesses mean, about what hallucinations are, what delusions are, how that could impact this. It's not that Dr. Trauber was gonna testify she had appendicitis, now she has a heart disease. That's not it at all. But he can, as a medical expert, testify about what mental illnesses are, what her previous diagnoses were. He was the one, as a matter of fact, that knew those from the record. It's not that he was going to sit up there and say, I have concluded that she did not have the intent to commit these crimes on the day. That is ultimate issue testimony. It would be permissible under Garcia, but that's not what the proffered testimony was.
But counsel, you keep framing this as a relevance issue. Wasn't it really a foundation issue? That there wasn't a foundation for the opinion that the defense wanted this expert to opine to? I mean, it seems to me that yes, it could be potentially relevant that this person had been diagnosed with certain situations in the past and that you had a witness there to explain what those meant. But none of that would be legally relevant unless there was a foundation for the witness having knowledge of what their situation was on the day in question. So this really all comes down and boils down to foundation, doesn't it?
Your Honor, the concepts of foundation and relevance were both discussed at the hearing. There was discussion of foundation, relevance, IRE 702, they all were in play. In terms of all of that, the only evaluation was Dr. Trauber's report, which is in the record, the confidential forensic psychological evaluation, and that talks about what he relied upon, what Ms. Oxford presented to him. That is the basis for what he would have testified. There's nothing apart from that. There's not some other report that would have been submitted. There's not, defense counsel said there were additional questions he wanted to ask Dr. Trauber, but that is the foundations. He evaluated her, I believe it was 6 weeks after the alleged criminal conduct. And to discuss how she presented at that time, I think certainly was relevant. I think the district court erred in concluding that it had no relevance to this case, that he could not testify as an expert, that it lacked foundation. All of those rulings were in play. All of those issues were raised below and decided by the district court.
So you're saying that a reasonable juror could have listened to the doctor's testimony and understood that her psychotic condition at the time that she was evaluated was at play at the time that she took the baby?
Precisely, Your Honor. So what the jury heard the audio recording where Miss Oxford is saying, "That's my baby, don't touch my baby," referencing the baby's name with a name similar to her 20-year-old son. But what the jury did not hear is any evidence as to what those could have meant, what her history could have been, the fact that she, again, had been diagnosed with schizophrenia 20 years prior, what hallucinations can do, how they can alter your perception of events, both factually, in this case, and as a matter of expert opinion, just simply as a psychologist can testify as to how mental illness can play with our perceptions of reality. All of that would have been helpful to the jury. Absent any such testimony, the district court said defense counsel can't argue any mental health issues to the jury. So the jury did not know, the jury was not allowed to consider the fact that lack of specific intent can be a defense in a case like this, where the specific intent is an element of the offense's charge.
Let's assume we follow your analysis for a moment. How would that withstand Rule 701 scrutiny? You're basically suggesting to Justice Brody that we would let basically someone without foundation make an argument that without foundation, they're essentially a lay witness, and asking the jury to connect the dots. Doesn't that undermine 702 and 703 at that point?
I don't know. I guess I'm not understanding your concern about foundation. Dr. Traberg evaluated her, looked at the records from county jail right after the incident, looked at the recordings of the incident, her explanation of the incident, heard her talk about her mental health history, her previous diagnoses. I don't know what's missing there in terms of the foundation.
Is there any place in the record then in which it was submitted to the district judge that this witness had the ability to testify as to what her requisite intent was or what her mental capacity was at the time of the incident? Was there any evidence presented to the judge that this witness was competent to testify or had a foundation to testify as to such things?
Not as to her intent at the time of the incident, but that's not the only way that her, I think that's the key here. You're right, and I've conceded from the day one, and defense counsel conceded below that he was not hired and could not provide an opinion as to her intent at the time. But what he could do is educate the jury about what mental health issues are, how mental health can come into play, what intent means interplayed with mental health diagnoses as a matter of expert opinion. Also, factually, he could talk about what she relayed to him, how he was involved, what he considered when he diagnosed her with a psychotic disorder.
But were the evidence scientific, don't you have to have an expert connect the dots for, you have to have an expert that can connect the dots for the jury? You're basically saying we have an expert that can point out some dots, but he can't connect them, but we're hoping the jury can.
I don't think we know precisely what he would have testified to. Defense counsel said that he wanted to talk to Dr. Trauber more and ask him some additional questions before he testified. That was all shut off when the district court ruled he would not be allowed to testify.
Did the defense counsel make an offer of proof as to what they could have testified to?
Simply the Dr. Trauber's report, which is in the confidential exhibits that this court has.
Okay, and is there anything in the confidential report that would satisfy what the standard that we've been discussing here?
I do think it satisfies the standard that it should have been permitted for the jury to hear his testimony. In terms of opining as to her intent on the date of the alleged criminal conduct, no. But in terms of providing evidence that was relevant to this case and could have been considered in her, and provided a defense, yes. I think those are two separate issues.
Articulate for me specifically what the district court's ruling was and what our standard of review is.
The standard of review is definitely abuse of discretion for an evidentiary issue. The district court's ruling was that he was, I have quote, completely, the testimony was completely irrelevant.
Don't we review relevance de novo?
We do, Your Honor. I think in the, I'm looking at the context of permitting expert testimony, but the issue of relevance is reviewed de novo. Thank you. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. On behalf of the state.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court and counsel. I'd like to jump right into the first issue here, and two questions come to mind for me. The first is, was this a denial? You know, did the district court actually deny the request for funding? And I think, Justice Stegner, your characterization of what the request was for was exactly right. It was really a two-part request, and the first was for the district court to sign off on the concept of having expert testimony. And then the second part is whether or not there would be funding. And if we want to talk about whether or not there was a denial of that motion, I think it helps to kind of go back through the record and trace the history of the motion itself. So if you look at page 113 of the record, you can see the motion for the appointment of the expert witness. And defense counsel said, based on Ms. Oxford's indigency status, it is requested that the court approve the defendant's request to retain a licensed psychologist or psychiatrist to assist the defendant in investigating the defense and to testify at the trial in this matter. So I think the based on indigency status can be read as, you know, perhaps a request for funding or perhaps not. But I think the second part there, it's approving a request to retain an expert witness. So now, if we fast forward to page 121 in the record and we look at the January 2018 hearing where this is taken up, the court's minutes don't say motion denied. They say grant motion for expert witness paid for by public defender. And so I really challenge the idea that this was a denial of the motion based on that, but also based on what happened next. So if you look at page 174 of the record, we have a brief in support of the motion in limine. And the defense counsel says that counsel for the defendant, he's referring to himself there, made a request for funds to be allocated from the public defender's office budget, but was denied because the funds were necessary for the defense of a capital case. So this court needs to ask itself, who is doing the denying there? That's not a reference to the court denying the request for the funds. That is the deputy public defender making a reference to, you know, his boss basically denying a request for funds because those funds were needed for a capital case. Now, what would have happened if the public defender who made that funding call would have said, yes, absolutely, we're going to take those funds and we're going to use it for Ms. Oxford's case? Would the court's order, could you even construe it as a denial at that point? No, you couldn't. And so my argument is that the court's order did not have the effect of a denial. It was Oxford's attorney's decision to not use the funds that it had for her case that had the effect of a denial. Now, this court has brought up IEC at a couple of junctures here, and I wasn't going to be the first one to mention it, but because it has been brought up, I think, yes, I think this court is right to think that this case is potentially better settled in post-conviction. And the reason why is because there are fragments of the record that would answer a lot of these questions that we just don't have. And one of the record-based things that would help us out in determining, well, why didn't trial counsel come back to the court and say, district court, I know that you said we should use the funds we have, but we have decided not to use those funds. Well, perhaps the trial counsel decided that Dr. Trauber's testimony would be perfectly fine. Perhaps trial counsel decided that Dr. Trauber was the witness that he intended to use. Perhaps trial counsel made an attempt to go find another expert witness, but couldn't find one. So we just don't have enough information on this point in this record to be sure that it was the district court's command to use the funds that Oxford already had that led to that ultimate decision to use Dr. Trauber.
Let's take a step back, Mr. Gons, for just a second. Would you not agree, though, that the district court's method of granting the motion for a expert in which he designated where the source of the funds for B would be certainly precipitated the issues that the defense struggled with thereafter?
I'm not trying to shift blame here, but I guess I think that the motion itself was framed in a way that I think both sides would say is a
You broke up there. Let me ask the question a little different way. If the district judge had simply said motion granted to be paid for with state funds, how would this case have turned out any differently?
Well, Your Honor, I would just note there was never a request for state funds in the first place. So I think if we're trying to kind of assign blame for why the court didn't rule on that particular issue, I think that I would maybe kind of point at the structure of the motion itself. But if the district court had said, I grant the motion and you are to use state funds, I'm not sure that that would really clarify the funding issue. The public defender's budget, the source of it was ultimately from the state. And so I think that the public defender would be complying with that order if he's saying use state funds. Well, the public defender's budget is state funds, right? And so I don't know that we would be in any different of a situation. But again, I think that if we're talking about, was there a denial here that we could even say could lead to an assignment of error on appeal, I don't think there was a denial of the motion, because really what the court was doing was saying, you have your budget, we've given you these funds, it's, January, it's early in the year. And so if you want to use the funds you have for this case, try that.
How would the trial court, though, have any idea what funds were available and how they were budgeted? Shouldn't this be the type of business that a trial judge completely stays out of and just says this is going to be paid for at county expense, or this is going to be paid for with state funds? When the judge starts talking about budget categories controlled by a different entity, it seems to me it's just asking for trouble.
Well, and I think if the court had gotten that deep into it, I can certainly understand this court's concern on that point. But I think it was just a function of the calendar year. And I think the court understood that, it understands that the public defender has a budget and it understands that it's early in the year. And so I think the court was reluctant to order additional funding when it knew that there was, potentially funding there in the first place. Now, I think this gets back to potentially what is trial counsel's obligation when trial counsel decides not to use those funds. Okay, I think the obligation at that point is to go back to the district court and say, you've made your ruling, and your ruling was to use the funds that we have. We've decided not to use the funds that we have, and we interpret that as you made an error, right? And it's our read of when the record says the motion has been granted, we actually read that as a denial of our motion. And then that might be a good time to bring up the constitutional arguments and basically everything else that has been raised now on appeal. But I think the onus was on Oxford's counsel to make those claims, because again, if Oxford's counsel had decided, look, we're going to use the funds we have, just like the district court said, then we wouldn't be here and we couldn't read the record as, a denial. And it's really just the decision of counsel that led to it, having the effect of a denial. But again, that's not a court error. And whether it was a error of counsel, I guess remains to be seen. Now, the other issue I'd just like to talk about a little bit was whether or not this was raised as a constitutional claim, and it absolutely was not. There was no authority that was cited in the original motion for appointment of an expert witness, no state law authority, no constitutional authority. And so I would just like to plant a flag there and say that based on years of this court's precedent dealing with issue preservation, and granting that there is a keyhole exception where a court's ruling might preserve an issue, and I'm talking about the Jeske case, even granting that, the the grant of the motion in this case was just simply not enough to preserve the panoply of constitutional arguments that we are dealing with on appeal.
And didn't we state in Olin that whenever a basic tool for a fair trial is requested by a defense attorney, that implicates the constitutional rights of that defendant without specifying which amendment or which Supreme Court case that's based on?
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, but I think the danger there is, well, how broadly will this court interpret a basic tool of constitutional fairness? I mean, you could make an argument that a motion to suppress is one of those tools to ensure a fair trial. And but we know that just getting a ruling on a motion to suppress is not sufficient to preserve every theory, every case, and every standard that you might want to raise later on appeal. And so we know from Garcia Rodriguez that you can have a ruling on a motion to suppress. And I think the state has well learned the lesson that simply because the court grants a motion to suppress, the state doesn't get to then use theory B that it maybe didn't raise below. And so I think just following that line and following the preservation law that this court has established over the last couple of years, just because you get a ruling on a motion and just because that might implicate some constitutional claims or issues, you can't then raise them for the first time on appeal. So I would argue that this claim would need to be raised under fundamental error, which I don't believe it has been. And I do believe that claim would fail essentially for all the reasons that I've been talking about here on the merits. I want to turn to the second issue, which is Dr. Traber's testimony. And counsel said, I think this kind of sums up my argument, which is, I don't think we know what Dr. Traber would have testified to. And Justice Mueller, you were exactly right when you asked about the offer of proof. And so this case comes down to an offer of proof. And if we don't know what Dr. Traber would have testified to, and if we don't know that Dr. Traber would have testified to the one thing that he was allowed to testify about, which is, well, is there a mental illness that negates an intent element? Well, then the district court correctly excluded that evidence. So if defense counsel had some statements that Dr. Traber would have made, if Dr. Traber would have, you know, taken the stand and said, well, look, I can tell you that what she was presenting with when I examined her, that was in full force 6 weeks ago. Or if he could have said, you know, let me, you know, connect the dots here and let me draw a line from now to 6 weeks prior. You know, I can imagine a hypothetical world where he could have said that, but the problem is that's not what is in the competency evaluation. And because that was not in the offer of proof, the district court correctly concluded that, no, you know, the jury is not going to be the one to connect the dots and make a clinical diagnosis when Dr. Traber himself would not do so. And Justice Mueller, you touched on whether or not this is a relevance versus foundational issue, and I think it's both. And I think the relevance piece is that what's in the competency evaluation is not relevant based on the standard set forth in 18207. But if we're saying that, well, Dr. Traber could have taken the stand and maybe he could have opined about things that are not in the competency evaluation, now we're talking about foundation, because the competency evaluation doesn't show that he had any foundation to talk about whether or not she could have formed the intent to commit the crime 6 weeks prior. And I would ask this court to just go through that competency evaluation. And, you know, you can see by looking at it, sure, there's an extensive history of severe mental illness, but those include numerous diagnoses, including schizophrenia, anxiety, and bipolar disorder. The competency evaluation doesn't show, well, which diagnosis was impacting her at what time. You know, did she struggle with anxiety or bipolar the majority of the time? Was it schizophrenia the majority of the time? And likewise, it says she was medicated much of her life, but what for? What was she medicated for? And what's particularly interesting is Oxford herself told Dr. Traber that she had not taken medication for 2 years because she did not feel they were necessary. And without the meds, she only had a difficulty concentrating. Now, she didn't indicate that since she was incarcerated, she had been medicated and placed on antipsychotics, and that she had improved concentration, but she said she indicated she had not been psychotic for some time. And so really, if you kind of look at the gestalt that's in the competency evaluation, yes, there's some information about struggling with mental illness. Yes, there's sort of this historical pattern that's discussed in just the vaguest terms. And we have a more specific informal diagnosis about, you know, what she's struggling with on the day of the evaluation. But what we don't have is that through line. And what we don't have is the connecting of the dots. And that is something that you need an expert to do. You need an expert to opine and say, yes, when I examined her, this issue was affecting her such that she couldn't form the intent to commit the crime 6 weeks prior. And I guess, I'll just throw this out there as well. You know, Ms. Oxford did talk about, I mean, I guess you could call it apparently delusional sort of motivations that she had for kidnapping the child. And so there's this kind of strange sort of soliloquy that she has about blood magic. But I would just point out to this court that even if you accept that the doctor could have drawn the line and said, well, she was suffering from this exact same thing 6 weeks prior, note that doesn't really get rid of her intent, right? So if you accept that she was suffering from a, you know, blood magic delusion on the date of the kidnapping, it doesn't say that she can't form the intent to kidnap the child. It just shows that, well, she did intend to kidnap the child for, you know, evidently delusional reasons.
Counsel, I'm not sure if it's legally compelling, but certainly there was an emotionally compelling argument made in appellant's brief and a footnote suggesting that the defendant had earlier in her life had a child kidnapped, a young male child with a very similar name, and perhaps was delusional that this child was in fact her child. Was there anything in the record like that presented to the trial judge?
Your Honor, I know that, so in the competency evaluation, in the discussion with Dr. Traber, there is a discussion about, the blood magic sort of delusional event being similar to something that she reported historically. But I'll note that the Dr. Traber, I don't think that he took that as gospel, as things that necessarily happened. I think that he concluded that some of her, you know, personal historical reporting was maybe exaggerated. And I know in his report, he also said that when she was talking about the night in question, she became kind of hyper-focused, but she was very disorganized in her thinking when it came to, things that happened in the past. But let me just grant for the sake of argument that she did have a past incident where she had a very, you know, traumatic kidnapping that happened to her as well. Now, first of all, I guess two things. The first is that doesn't do anything to undo intent either, right? Because that just really shores up the intent element. If she had a horrific childhood experience and Dr. Traber could say, yeah, she had this horrific childhood experience and that's why she did what she did, that again just shows that she intended to kidnap the child, but it was based on some trauma that she had. But I think the more important point here is that is not in the offer of proof. The offer of proof found in the competency evaluation does not say, well, you know, I'm opining to some reasonable degree of clinical certainty that the reason why she kidnapped the child was because of this childhood trauma. It doesn't say that. And so again, not to keep beating this drum, but we've talked about IEC before, and I think that the limitation of the offer of proof might be fertile grounds for post-conviction as well, because I'd like to point out that counsel knew way back in July that it would be on him to produce more than what was in the competency evaluation. And what I'm thinking of specifically is if we look at the July 2nd, 2018 hearing, and that transcript is in the record, the court asks defense counsel, is the competency evaluation the extent of the opinions Dr. Traber is going to offer? So already we have concerns. And defense counsel said, yes, you know, I have that eval, but he indicates that he's been talking to Dr. Traver, and he says, I've talked to him. He wants to talk to me further, but I hadn't anticipated him trying to render an opinion about whether she understood, whether she had the mental capacity at the time. So the court followed up by that by saying, you know, I'm going to defer the ruling, but I'm not sure if you have sufficient factual foundation. That was in July. So from, you know, July, August to mid-September, we had a period of, you know, 2.5 to 3 months where trial counsel knew that, you know, the competency evaluation may not be enough to get Dr. Traver in, but we also know there were some lines of communication there. They were talking. You know, he was in discussions with him, just like he would be in discussions with any other expert witness. And yet, for the offer of proof, what did he submit? He submitted the same competency evaluation that he had had way back in July that he knew or should have reasonably known from the court would not have been sufficient to get Dr. Traver's testimony in. So again, I'm just trying to forecast out here, you know, why did trial counsel just submit the thing that was we already knew was probably not going to be enough? Was it because he didn't talk to Dr. Traver? Is it because he did talk to Dr. Traver and Dr. Traver was unable to, you know, basically say the magic words and say, look, I can talk about 6 weeks prior? We just don't know. But knowing that would, I think, help resolve this question in post-conviction. But again, you know, coming back to the offer of proof, it's the defendant's offer of proof that really guides whether or not the testimony is admissible or not. And I think the district court correctly excluded the testimony based on the offer of proof for the reason that what was in the competency evaluation would not have shown that Ms. Oxford did not or could not form the intent to commit the crime. And that was the key relevant thing that that evidence could have come in for. And I guess, well, Ms. Reynolds, in an act of mercy to me, is submitted on the restitution issue. And so I would also submit on that issue unless this court has any questions.
I would appreciate knowing what the state's view is the proper remedy, assuming that we do find that the trial judge dropped the ball on that issue. How do we remedy that?
That's a good question, Your Honor. I mean, so my view is that the proper remedy would be to vacate and remand and essentially give the state, though the state may not have earned such an opportunity, I think give the state a second chance to give that information. And let me make my pitch to you. I'm thinking of the victim here. We have a victim who was injured. And, you know, if we go through the PSI, you can see that, well, there was this shoulder injury. And so we know that, you know, at least potentially there are hospital bills involved. And I know that they didn't rise to the level of detail that the district court wanted. You know, I think it's important if you tell a court, you know, you're going to do something that you do it. And I think it's important for the state to follow through with these things. And so all of that said, if the state indicated to the court that it had the information, I think my view is just that if this court determines there was an error, to just, you know, vacate the restitution award and give the state an opportunity, unearned though it may be, to provide that information. And again, really, this is just a just sort of plea on behalf of the victim, you know, because again, there was an injury here, and I think that that's important that that restitution be ordered. I not to get into the merits of this issue too much, but it's possible that you know, the district court was expecting basically two sides of briefing to come into it. And I think I can, you know, I can point out to this court the statements at the hearing. Basically, the court said the state has 2 weeks to get the information in, and the defendant will have a week to file a subsequent objection. And at that point, the court would deal with it at that time. So it's at least, you know, imaginable to me that the court thought that, well, I'm waiting on an objection as well, this subsequent objection. And if it didn't get the subsequent objection, perhaps the court concluded that, well, there's just been, you know, a de facto agreement to the restitution. But all of that said, I can certainly understand if this court concludes that there was an error. But if it does conclude there was an error, I would just ask that the state be given a second opportunity to get that information in.
So Mr. Gans, in follow-up to that plea for the victim restitution, isn't the money that was paid to these medical providers paid by the Industrial Commission and not the actual victim?
I believe that may be so, Your Honor, although I confess to not poring over that before today, but I believe that is so.
So the victim, the woman who was injured, is not out of pocket money, isn't that correct?
That may be true, Your Honor. I think, on the principle of things, it's, the taxpayers of the state of Idaho, maybe it's that won't tug at your heartstrings as much. But I think it's just a practical consideration from my perspective. If the documentation is out there and the state told the court it had the documentation, it seems to me to at least be easier to just remand, provide the information. Although perhaps you've diluted the strength of my
well, and it could be an important appeal. Question for us to resolve, because obviously there's a constitutional component to the victim's restitution right. I'm not sure if the Industrial Commission is subject to those same rights granted by the Constitution to the direct victim in the case. Do you have an opinion on that?
Well, confessing that I didn't expect this court to view the restitution issue as the groundbreaking issue before it, but I should say I don't have an opinion, because I don't know that that's been raised in this case, and I view this, in my view, this is just more of a reasonably argued blooper and reasonably presented mistake. To me, the question is, well, what do we do now? And so are we going to essentially punish the victim and punish the Industrial Commission for the state's mistake? And I can understand if this court goes down that road, but I'm suggesting that it would just be a little bit easier to vacate, remand, and give another opportunity for it. But unless this court has any questions, I would ask you to affirm the judgment of conviction for all the reasons we talked about. Thank you.
Thank you. How much time does the appellant have?
The appellant has 1 minute, Your Honor.
Ma'am?
Thank you. May it please the court. With respect to restitution, it was a payment to the Idaho Industrial Commission. Defense counsel had already objected. There's nothing to file a subsequent objection to. The state actually had two prior opportunities. This would be granting the state a third opportunity, not a second opportunity. At this point, that restitution order should simply be vacated. That I do not, however, think is the most important issue presented to this court in this case. I do think it's the first two issues. The first, she wasn't suffering from a blood magic delusion. She was arguably suffering from a this is not my child delusion that would play into the elements of this offense. Defense counsel knew it from day one of his representation of Ms. Oxford. He had concerns about this case. This is not, however, simply an IAC case. To throw this off into post-conviction, I think, would be a huge injustice. To think Ms. Oxford could pursue that would be... hard to imagine, but more importantly, legally, this is the issues were raised below, decided below. They are presented for this court to review on appeal under an abuse of discretion standard and with relevance, perhaps, de novo standard. I would ask this court, I see my time is out. I'd ask this court to reverse.
Thank you, ma'am. Matters now under advisement. We will render decision. We'll talk to the court in conference at 11:30. Anything further? Court's in recess. Thank you.